Okay, can everyone hear me okay? Yep, all good. All right, might just give it one more minute and we'll get started. God, everybody's tweeting. I just tweeted that. You wanna make a point, but you keep preaching. You had me from the start, won't let this end. First you wanna go to the left, then you wanna turn right. Alright. Might make a start. Thanks everyone for coming. It's after lunch. I know everyone's probably feeling a little bit sleepy. I'll try to make this as exciting as I can make it. I think it's a very interesting topic, and it's really about imparting some of the knowledge that me from Rackspace, we deal with very large customer environments in Azure, and hopefully pass on some knowledge and some key sort of lessons learned. And some of the findings that we've found from some of the larger scale deployments that we've had to do for customers. So I'm a solution architect out of Sydney for Rackspace Australia. I do deal primarily in all things Microsoft, open source, Azure is my baby. I do quite a lot of Azure work, quite a lot of hands-on. I did a session yesterday on deploying ARM templates, so if you missed that, it's going to be recorded, so you can catch up with that. So with that, my details are down the bottom, so feel free to come and grab me after the session or just shoot me an email. I'm happy to help you out. Or tweet RuskyDuck72. So I'll do a quick intro. We'll talk about what a large-scale deployment looks like. Is it one VM? Is it multiple VMs? Is it multiple environments? Some subscriptions. So when you've got a large-scale environment, how to handle multiple subscriptions and lots of different sort of environments running in those subscriptions. Tagging, which is very, very important when you've got a large-scale environments for customers. Storage, networking, automation, monitoring, and we'll have a general Q&A. I won't keep the questions to the end. Feel free at any time to raise your hand and ask me a question throughout the session. So there's no demos or anything. It's just me just rabbiting on about stuff. So feel free to interrupt me at any time if something doesn't make sense. So a little bit about me. I work for Rackspace. I've already mentioned that. I'm a certified solution expert in Azure, so I've done all three certs. Been doing IT for over 20 years, so got a lot of battle scars and a lot of interesting stories to tell over a campfire. So with a large-scale deployment for Azure, what does that actually look like? What does that mean? So I put this up here to show you, these are the services you've got as of when I put this slide together. There's probably more than this now. These are sort of the services that you need to be able to stitch together to make your Azure applications work. So you've got, you know, BizTalk, you've got site recovery, you've got, infrastructure as a service. There's a lot of things you need to pull together, need to automate and pull all this together to make your applications work for your customers. You can do lift and shift, you can do infrastructure as a service, VM moves and whatnot. But there's a lot of things you need to consider, and there's a lot of planning you need to do, particularly with large-scale environments, to make it worthwhile. This is sort of what I like to call a medium to high degree of complexity. So this is something that we kind of do. I actually got this from a Microsoft site, so I can't claim credit for this. But this is what we call very much a standard sort of deployment. So you've got an active data center and a passive data center. So the active is obviously where the live traffic is being put to, and you've got multiple virtual machines in availability set, and obviously with load balancing. And you've got your SQL servers and everything like that. Who here has deployed something like that? Who found it fun? How did you do it? Did you automate it? Did you do it manually? What were your...
Yeah, automated.
Automated, cool. That's the way you should do it, by the way. So this is one way of doing this. There's multiple ways of doing this. This is very much infrastructure as a service deployment. So it's obviously all VMs. You can mix and match it with various other platform as a service offerings. This is another one that we've done for a customer. This is one single application. So when I say large scale deployments, I mean not necessarily just one application. We've got customers who've got multiple applications like this running at the same time. So we've got to deploy maybe 50 of these at once. All different sorts of configurations, all different sizes. So to give you an idea, we've got customers that spend upwards of 150 to 200K a month just in Azure, just on this sort of stuff. So we've got some pretty big customers that have got a large amount of workloads running in the cloud. Obviously, we've got to make them, you know, relatively resilient, and there's different ways of doing that. And obviously, we've got to automate that. So you wouldn't do this manually, because at the scale and the rate at which we've got to deploy these, we've got to do it in a repeatable way. So remember, this is just, you got UAT, you got prod, and you got DR, but typically this is one application. So you might have to multiply this by how many applications that you have. This is another one. This is a Rackspace internal one. This is sort of another sort of standard one. It looks reasonably scary. It's not that scary, to be honest. I just want to draw your attention to the right-hand side, though. What we do at Rackspace, and this is a practice I think everyone should follow, is when you've got virtual machines, you shouldn't just open up the virtual machines to the outside network and RDP into any machine. Bad idea. What we do is we have, and I'll go through this in a little bit more detail, is the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see the Rackspace Bastion subnet. What we have is we have network security groups wrapped around that which map to our pass-through gateways that allow only Rackspace employees to basically connect to that box. So if anyone tries to hack it, they can't get into it. It's basically a bastion host or a jump box, effectively. That's a way of doing that. So that basically allows our support folks to jump onto that environment and then do what they need to do to the environment. We also provide one-time passwords. So when you log into that piece of kit, you can only log onto it once. The next time you do it, you need to regenerate a password, and it's a one-time session. So that's basically how we do it. It's a good way of doing it. Is it perfect? It can be a bit tricky to get going and set up, but once you've done it quite a few times, it's a good practice to have. Does that make sense? Everyone okay with that? Subscriptions, the bane of my existence. Probably Gino's too in the audience here did a session on that yesterday, I think, on subscription. What we find is this can be a real bone of contention for a lot of customers. We've had arguments with customers saying, do we have one subscription? Do we have multiple? And the answer is, it depends, right? We find customers that want to do just one deployment and that's it. Typically what we find, it's a good idea to have one subscription per sort of environment or workload. Example, dev, test, prod. Now the reason for that is you're not going to allow your developers to production. That's crazy, you wouldn't do that. We've got customers that do it and they get themselves into all sorts of trouble. What else you want to look at is securing those subscriptions with named accounts. So when users log in, they're not just using the Microsoft account. I wouldn't use that. I'd actually create named accounts in Azure AD and use those accounts to log in. Another interesting one that we come across too is enterprise agreements. The interesting thing is when you subscribe Azure subscription to an EA, the billing disappears from the portal, the Azure portal. It gets rolled up into the EA portal. So it's a very interesting conversation to have with customers why they can't see the billing, but it all gets rolled up. So there are tools through Power BI and whatnot that allow you to do that. Another good practice too is restrict access to production to your devs. So we've seen cases where devs go in and delete stuff, storage accounts, whatnot, and it can cause all sorts of havoc. So as I mentioned there too, I've got tips throughout this too. So at the end, I'm going to list all the tips and tricks that we've found. So the big key takeaway for this is just think about the tips. I'm giving you a background, but there's a bunch of tips you can go away and think, oh, we can apply that to our own environments. So as I mentioned, use named accounts. And the other one is use billing alerts as well. So if your billing or your subscriptions are getting a bit out of hand, you can set thresholds, which I think are still in preview, to enable billing alerts for certain metrics. Sorry, I'll get the microphone. Sorry, the question was, where do you set the billings? You set them in there's an accounts.manageazure.com, I think. Is it separate to the Azure portal? Yeah, the accounts portal. And it's in preview as well. And it just sends you an email based on the particular thresholds. It's actually a good way to keep an eye on it. It'd be nice if it was in the Azure portal itself, but it's actually rolled up into the accounts portal. Yep, cool. So typically, this is the diagram that we show customers. It's very, very straightforward. So obviously, you've got an account administrator, which is sort of at the attendance level. And then what you can do is set up service administrators, and you've got different environments, dev, staging, prod. So that allows you to set up the administrators at each of those levels and also for the co-administrators. It's not really rocket science, but it's amazing how quickly this can get out of hand and how chaotic it can become. Sorry, I was getting a drink of water. It's very, very simple, and it's a good way to show customers a good way. And look, it's not the right way of doing it. It's not necessarily the wrong way of doing it. It's just the way we've found the best way for large scale, lots of subscriptions to manage it. Otherwise, it becomes an unwieldy mess. I think I want to draw your attention to as well is something we come across a lot is when you provision a brand new subscription. These two. So what we found when you're doing data center lift and shifts, this is straight off the MSDN, it's well documented, but I just wanted to point these out. So when you go and provision a brand new subscription, you get 20 CPU cores by default for the subscription, which you can increase up to a maximum of 10,000. So the reason for that is that you don't just blow your limits out too quickly, and you can get those increased via raising a support ticket with Microsoft. So there are what they call hard limits and soft limits. These are what we call soft limits. The ones on the left are the defaults. The hard limit is 10,000. The other one is storage accounts per subscription. Now, we'll cover storage in a little bit more detail later on, but you can get the storage accounts increased up to 250, and there's other ones there, but they're the two key ones we see. Probably the top one is the one we see most often, especially with large migrations, etc. So that's where you really need to think about, going back to this slide, how you plan this out. So you've got those limits in mind, you plan your subscriptions, you may have to have more than what we've listed there. Does that make sense? Any questions on that? So we'll go to tagging. Who's not familiar with tagging in Azure? Who's familiar with tagging in AWS? Who doesn't know what tagging is? Okay. So what tagging is, this is something new that got introduced with Azure Resource Manager. What this allows us to do is basically assign name-value pairs, basically name the resources. So you've got for instance, an environment name is test, and the owner could be Fred, date is today. And it just allows you to be able to name the resources so you can identify them and associate them with a cost center or a business unit or whatnot. So it allows you to roll it up into billing and get an idea of where things are being spent, and you can also do searches and whatnot based on tags. It allows you to group common resources too, so you can group them together based on a tag. AWS has had this for a long time. Microsoft's put it in there. It's actually a really good thing. It's very handy to have. It allows you to group resources. I covered that. So you've got a maximum of 15 tags per resource. Typically, we don't tag every single resource in a resource group. It really depends on what the customer wants. We tend to do it at the resource group level. So I'll show you that in a second. And you've got the maximum of 512 characters in the name, and the value is 256. So some examples: environment, dev, test, prod, cost center, and an owner. And obviously, if you're using Azure Classic, it doesn't support tagging. So that's why ARM is so good. Another tip for you: we've got customers who enforce where resources aren't tagged to automatically shut those resources down. So it's a common practice we're seeing more and more in large enterprise customers. So you've got devs deploying stuff like a Wild West show. They don't tag it, it gets destroyed. We see that a lot. It's actually a very good way to save money. And it's very, very funny to see the developers, how quickly they change their habits without doing that. It's a great tip, that one will save you a lot of money. We had a customer a little while ago that one of their devs left a G-series machine running for a month. Got a $12,000 bill on the boss's corporate card. How do you think that went? It's a lot of frequent flyer points. The boss might have been happy. So this is what it looks like. In your ARM templates, you can basically put your tags. So for instance, environment test, project is the update project, and the team is finance. So don't worry about the rest of it. That's where you can put your tags, and that's at the network security group level. So what we're doing here is applying a tag to the network security group. I mean, you can do this. Just remember, there are limits inside Azure to do this. So if you put too many tags on resources, you'll run out of the amount of tags that you have. And when you go to the Azure portal, that's what it kind of looks like. Everyone see that? Is that? So environment test, project update. And when you can start doing things with billing, then you can do consolidated views on different environments based on those tags. So that's why they're actually really important and very handy to use. I'm going for time here. So any questions on tagging, resources, anything like that? Storage, this is a very interesting one. What we find is this seems to confuse a hell of a lot of people. Customers automatically think, we need to have everything redundant all the time, and it's not always that easy. So just to give you a bit of a recap how storage kind of works. So, I mean, everybody familiar with storage, how it works in Azure? Everyone's got a bit of an idea? Yep, cool. Everyone not know. Don't be afraid. Yeah, it's cool. That's why you're here, right? To understand this. So you've got you've got four options: LRS, ZRS, GRS, and RAGRS, or read only GRS, or geo redundant storage. So you look at the top there. Data is replicated across multiple data centers. LRS, no. But what it actually does, it will actually replicate it across the data center in three separate racks inside the data center. Whereas you look at something like GRS, it'll replicate it across two regions. So for instance, you deploy a storage account in Australia East as LRS, it'll stay in Australia East and only replicate in that data center. So if that region goes offline, potentially you could lose your data, potentially. Whereas you've got geo-redundant, it's replicated three times in Australia East and Australia Southeast. Because the way Microsoft does their data centers, they have what they call redundant pairs. This is actually well documented. So in the Australia region, there's Australia East and Australia Southeast, and they're both redundant to each other. So you've got Australia East is redundant to Australia Southeast, and Australia Southeast is redundant to... So if either one of them fail, one will become the primary, one will become the secondary. So Microsoft will do that for you. You don't have to touch it. The other one that's very interesting is RAGRS. So in the event of a failure, it will automatically fail over to that storage account, but you can still read the data from it, you just can't write from it. So that's a really good way if you've got things like you want to deploy reports or run reports or pull things over a storage account without impacting performance of the environment, you can do it that way. And as I mentioned before, the number of copies are kept in the separate nodes. LRS is 3 and the others are 6. Make sense? Now, this is a really interesting thing we come across a lot. People have this misconception about overloading storage accounts. So the trick is, and I'll show you what the effect will be on this. What I mean by overload storage accounts is you create a bunch of virtual machines and you put all the VHDs into one storage account. Not a really good recommendation to do that. What we've seen is you should have probably no more than, say, 20, probably pushing 40 in one storage account, because there is an IOPS limit inside the storage accounts of 20,000 IOPS on non-premium storage. So that will impact your performance of your VMs, and it'll also you'll get throttling errors and you'll get all sorts of alerts firing off. So the key thing is plan your pricing tiers. It is well documented. Just make sure if you've got a very, very heavy workload, move it to its own storage account. That would be my recommendation. As I said, avoid single storage accounts too, because you've got one single storage account, all your VMs in that storage account. You lose that storage account, have a guess what happens. Amazing how many times we see this with customers. They ask for it, we tell them no, and we actually see this quite a lot because they want to save on cost or complexity, and we're like, it's not a great idea. So what we say is, look, the rule of thumb is typically is one storage account per VM. Kind of you can do that, but you'll run out of storage accounts before you know it. So what you could do is group your storage accounts together, say web tier, app tier, data tier, and keep them in the same storage account. You could do that as long as you observe the limits. So the other thing too is standard storage is 5,000 IOPS per disk. So if you want to use standard storage, you want to get perf out of it, you've got to do striping using storage spaces or something in Windows, or you could stripe it in Linux. Premium is a max of 5,000 IOPS per disk. Tip number 4, this is a great one. We see this one come up quite a bit. Customers go, oh, we want to encrypt all our storage. Now, the misconception is if you deploy a storage account, put data in there, turn encryption on, it will encrypt the data. Incorrect. What you have to do, if you've got VHDs in a storage account and you encrypt it, you've actually got to move them out and copy them back in, then they'll be encrypted. So it's a good idea to provision them with encryption turned on. There's a little tip for you. You can do that through ARM. It's pretty straightforward. It's just a flag in the ARM template. Encryption, no. Where the performance impacts you will see is if you use SQL in GRS, which is not recommended by the SQL product team. So you can do it, just don't do it. Because the problem is, what happens is when you write data in a GRS scenario, it has to write it 6 times. It'll do it asynchronously, but there is a performance hit. So when you're doing SQL workloads, always try to keep them as LRS. Obviously premium storage, but LRS, and then copy the data. Don't do GRS with SQL. Bad idea. Yeah.
What about storage pools? Would you ever do GRS with that? I heard it's
You can. What we tend to do, we try to keep it really simple. We try to keep it as LRS and back it up where we can, because we use Recovery Vault. So we back up machines, we back up the whole machine, we snapshot it and store it into blob storage or whatnot. But you can. Look, I've not tried it with storage pools with GRS. You could do it. The problem is it may have a performance impact as well, because it's got to write it, well, it's striping, I guess, but it could be a performance impact as well. Yeah, so the question was, will it be an impact on performance with storage pools in Windows? And I guess it really depends on what sort of workload. Yeah, so encryption, we've covered that. Now, this is another interesting one, which is not that well known. How you name your storage accounts. So most people go dev storage account one, dev storage account two. It looks okay on paper, but it's actually not quite right. Now, this has been fixed, and I'll come to this in a second. What happens is, if you do that, it will potentially bind what they do, the storage accounts, to a particular partition server, and it will put it onto the one stamp in the Azure data center. So what you need to do is, this can be a really big performance impact on large amounts of virtual machines. You've got four or five VMs, typically not a problem. You've got hundreds, you've got thousands of VMs, you've got a fleet of VMs. This will be a performance impact, without a doubt. What will happen is when you start doing this and you start naming the storage accounts and putting a lot of workloads into those, you'll start finding that a rebalancing event will occur, and it's got to do stuff on the Azure back end. And this can have a really big performance impact. So the tip around this is to prefix your storage accounts with a three-digit hash. And there's ARM templates to do this, and this is well documented, just not that easy to find, and it's not really a highlighted thing. Now, to be honest, this will only be an issue if there's a large amount of virtual machines. You've got a really big fleet, this will be an issue. You may find it's for a smaller, like 100 VMs, you may find this be an issue as well. And I'll show you what it's talking about. Can you read that? It's probably a little bit blurry. So you see the storage account names here, ABCD storage 1 through to storage 4. Notice the cluster they're on, especially 3 and 4. They're on the same cluster in the Azure data center. Whereas I've got the ones with the unique three-digit hash at the storage account names, they're spread across different clusters in the Azure data center. So that will automatically push them out to different stamps in the Azure data center for both performance and for resiliency of the underlying storage. It's actually it's a real gotcha, particularly we've got large enterprise clients, really large enterprise clients, where we've come across this quite a bit, and we've spoken to the storage team about some of this stuff, and they said, look, there's new stuff coming. And luckily there is. I don't think I've got the slide for this. No, it didn't come in. So luckily for us, this goes away now. You might have heard of a concept called managed disks. Who has not heard of managed disks? Okay, so what this basically does now is Microsoft takes care of all of this for you. You don't have to worry about the naming of the storage. Basically what you do, create a VM, create a disk, and away you go. You don't have to worry about naming storage accounts, LRS. You have to still specify LRS and premium and whatnot, but Microsoft will take care of all of this underlying infrastructure for you. So it's literally, as the name implies, managed disk. It is a managed service that Microsoft will look after for you.
Is the cluster name completely abstracted?
It's abstracted, yeah. Question was, is the cluster name and everything abstracted? Yes, it is. Yep.
With managed disks,
Good question. The question is, do managed disks have an impact on the number of storage accounts? Yes, it does. There is a limit of the number of storage accounts managed disk accounts per subscription. And I think the number, top of my head, I think it's 200 soft limit. So you can get that increased. Let me double check that, because this disk guidance is only really new. It only came out like last Wednesday. Literally, we found out about it. So what managed disks allows you to do. Now, the other thing, actually another tip for you with managed disks as well, the maximum size of the managed disk is still 1 terabyte. I think that's going to change in the future, so you still need to think about the 1 terabyte limit on the disk size for the managed disk. But for us, and there is a migration path too. So if you've done storage accounts, there is a migration path to prepare the VMs, move it to managed disk, but you've got to reboot the VM to take effect for the new underlying storage infrastructure. But it'll just take care of itself, hopefully. No, it will, trust me. But it just simplifies the whole deployment too now, so you don't have to worry about any of this. any of this stuff here. It's this really, and to be clear, this is only really affecting virtual machines. This will only impact virtual machines, this issue here. This is where we've seen it, whereas you got things like pure blob storage, and this is like page blobs. You've got pure blob storage of images and things like that. It's not so much a real impact of that, but it's really with virtual machines. But managed disks, I'd suggest checking them out. And there are ARM templates now too for deploying them. So in the mentioned yesterday in my session, there's a repository of ARM templates you can download. They're in there now, so you can down and start provisioning this stuff with managed disks, and I encourage looking at that. Any questions, concerns? Yeah. So the question was? SQL Direct Blob Storage. Would it affect, the question is, would the naming of the storage accounts affect SQL Blob Storage? Yeah. Underlying, it could potentially, because you may not see it. This, I'm just calling this out. You may not see a performance impact. It's really each individual, results may vary. Where it will be impacted if you use geo-redundant storage. It's a direct impact. And even the Microsoft guidance from the SQL team is to say not to use geo-redundant storage for that. It's a bit of planning, but for SQL workloads, I would just go straight to managed disks. It's released, it's fully utilized, and you can migrate too. So I would suggest looking at that. Okay. All right, well, let's look at some networking. This is another one we love. Who's done battle with virtual networks? Who's played with Azure, site-to-site VPNs, ExpressRoute? Who enjoys it? Who doesn't like it? That's good to see. At least you're honest. We've got Christian in the room too, so from Microsoft, so we can have it. He's going to get me later. So the trick is with networking is you've really got to plan it. What we've seen is, in particular with ExpressRoute and site-to-site VPNs, we see a lot of cases where overlapping IP addresses kill us. We go to customers, look, we've got this range inside a CIDR block, inside a virtual network. Tell us what the ranges are so we don't overlap. And they assure us that the range won't overlap. We fire up ExpressRoute, guess what? The ranges overlap and we get all sorts of issues. So really make sure that you really hassle the firewall guys, the networking guys, and get them all in a room and have nerf fights to see who wins. That's what we generally do, and see who wins. Not real, I'm kidding. The thing is, too, with networking, you will potentially deploy and redeploy. Now, the issue is with some of the networking assets, in particular to virtual networks, is once you deploy them, you can't rename them. So once you deploy them, they're basically immutable. You can't rename them. You can't really do anything beyond that. So you've got to tear them down and redeploy them. We have spoken to the Microsoft networking guys about this, and they said, look, it's not really possible because the VNet name is in the URI of the resource. I'm not sure why they did that, but anyway, that's why they've done it. I would, with networking too, don't overcomplicate it. Keep it simple, keep your CIDR block simple, keep your network design simple. You'll thank yourself later on. And as I talked about yesterday in my ARM template discussion, you can layer your deployments. So you can do the VMs, you can do the VNets, you can layer your deployments to make it a lot easier to maintain. Now, the other thing we've got, we always have an issue with customers, they've got this idea of one big giant VNet. It's old school IT. Just have a data center in the cloud. It's one big VNet. You could do that. We've got customers that do it. We don't like it because it's very hard to make changes and you're restricted by the CIDR blocks. Typically, what we recommend is to use VNet peering, which has now been out for a while and it's really cool. Another tip, gateway subnets. If anyone says to you, use anything but a /27, incorrect. They should use a /27 on the gateway subnet, and the gateway subnet must be named gateway subnet as it's typed there, or stuff won't work. Another one, tip number 6, this kills me. We had a customer recently who decided to put network security groups at the NIC level. Everything just broke. We just couldn't work out why. And they said, we didn't change anything. So went to the audit logs. This is where those named accounts come in. Went through the audit logs, found out who did it, emailed them and sent a screenshot. And they said, oh, yeah, we did change something. So, yeah, that was a very fun conversation to have with that customer. Look, if we break something, our named accounts, we'll fess up. There's no hiding. There's audit logs. There's traceability. So just a little tip for you. So this is typically how we deploy stuff at Rackspace. This is a typical virtual network. This is just a model that we use for this sort of stuff. Sorry, it's a bit blurry, it's a bit small, but you get the sort of the idea. Let's see if this laser pointer works. I shouldn't be really using your laser pointer. So typically what we do is we deploy a virtual network. We have a management resource group with the gateway subnet. We have the Rackspace resource group, blob storage. Well, now we can use managed disks, so we can use that. And typically we have a subnet per sort of piece of the environment. For instance, DMZ, app, inside, and auth. What we do there is we lock those down pretty heavily. What we restrict is communication between the different subnets unless we specify the ports. The reason for that is we want to stop promiscuity of the network between the different subnets. So for instance, if a virtual machine in the DMZ gets compromised, it'll stop the promiscuous network activity from that subnet to hit the other one. So that's why we do it that way. Because typically by default, if you deploy it without any ESGs, the subnets will be able to communicate, no worries, but we restrict that. Because a lot of the customers we deal with have to be PCI compliant and whatnot, so we restrict it down quite heavily at the NSG level at the subnet layer. This is typically what they look like. So don't worry about this too much. This is typically what the network security groups we deploy. This is all done through ARM. This is all automated. You notice here we've got some allow local subnet. We've got bastions and all that. Remember those bastions I was talking about? This is where we allow the bastions to come in from that subnet. And everything else is restricted. So deny all inbound UDP, deny all inbound TCP. So we restrict everything unless we specify it from a particular port or from a known source. It just makes it a lot more restrictive, unfortunately, but it actually makes things a lot more secure, and you'll thank yourself in the end. I mean, as I said, individual results may vary for each of your environments, but this is the way we typically do it. And if you ever get audited by, you know, KPMG or whatnot, they want to look at this stuff, you've got it sorted. Does that make sense? Yeah, mate. Excellent question. So the question is, can you visualize the results before you go and deploy the network security group rules? Or is that what?
Even often. So I want to look at what does my network, my VNet actually look like at the moment, and where are my NSGs and some sort of.
Yeah, there are some tools out there. There's a couple of answers to that question. I have actually asked, again, the networking guys at Microsoft about what would be really nice is to see a resultant set of policies at the NSG level to see what is actually going to be impacted prior to me deploying it. That's something that I think they're going to look at. So prior to hitting a button, what is the end state going to look like? Secondly, there are visualization tools where you can pull things in. I think ArmViz is one. There's a couple of other tools that can visualize it for you. And there's also there's a visualization tool in Azure. For some of this stuff, you can see it. But is that?
There's a sort of pre, I can look at my template with ArmViz, but can I look at my actual deployment?
You have to go into it. There are ways of visualizing it through the Azure portal, but it's not great. There's not a lot of granularity at that level. I know what you're asking. Yeah, it's difficult. I know there is some stuff they're looking at in the works. It's just I'm not sure how far along with the visualization piece. It's a good question, particularly when you've got a large environment, it can get very complicated. Ideally, I'd love to be able to reverse engineer what I've deployed and put it into like a Visio diagram or something. That would be awesome. So there's a little side project for anyone who's keen. We've got the time. Who's got time? So who's not done anything with VNet peering? Who's never touched it? Who's never heard of it? So we employ this quite a bit for our customers. This is actually a really nice way of decluttering the virtual network. So rather than having one big giant virtual network, you have smaller, more manageable virtual networks. So again, the same rules apply. You're going to make sure you don't have overlapping IP addresses between the virtual networks. Second rule, they can't span regions. So you can't have a virtual VNet peering between Australia East and Australia Southeast. It won't allow it. It's got to be in the same region. To do that, you need a site-to-site VPN and all that sort of stuff. You can share express route connections and whatnot. But where this is really handy is you can have a group of virtual machines for, say, one application peering to down the bottom there, let's just pretend there's an express route connection. You can share an express route connection and make this a really simple way of deploying your applications. It just makes life so much easier. And if you need to make a change, you don't have to make a change at the big virtual network level. You can do it at the individual VNet level for each of the peered children on the ends. It makes life so much easier for just large-scale deployments. Does that make sense? Does that, anyone not clear on that, how that works? It's very easy to set up. There's ARM templates, there's PowerShell. It's very simple to get going with that. I'm sorry? No. Now you can't do peering between two different regions. So Australia East and Australia Southeast, you can't.
So how would you those two communicate?
You have to pray. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. There's a few different ways of doing it. You could do it with a site-to-site VPN over the different regions. Just be wary of, you know, you're sort of going to go through. Depends on how you do it. You could do it where we've done it for other customers. It's with a shared express route connection. You could do that, or you could do it with site-to-site VPN or, you know, some third-party tools. I have asked about it, and they said, look, the reason for not enabling that feature across regions is purely the latency. They can't guarantee the latency because there are latency SLAs, and there are SLAs around the VNet peering. And the only way they can maintain those is with the keeping it within a region. Good question, though. It's a common one. Automation. Like, so let me just check I've covered everything with that one. Yes, the other thing you can do is you can peer between classic and resource manager subscriptions as well in the same tenant. So just something else. If you've got where this is really handy, if you're going to use Azure ADDS, now, for some reason, it's still in classic. To use that in ARM, you've got to do VNet peering. We do this all the time. And I'm told that ADDS is going to be brought to ARM soon-ish, so you don't need the classic side of things. So who's not familiar with ADDS? Anyone not heard of that? It's basically Active Directory in the cloud where you can do domain join and all of that without having any domain controllers running in this environment. It's really nice, actually. It makes things so much easier. Automation. You're probably getting a theme here. I'm a big fan of automation. Trust me, particularly with a very large-scale environment or environments, you need to automate this stuff. Have different variables, different parameters, but keep it all automated because the problem you're going to have is someone goes in and changes something, you're going to have drift to the environment. What this allows this to happen is this avoids that drift of the original environment. So you make a change, you should do it in your ARM templates and redeploy it, not go in and do it manually. The reason being, you go in and change it manually, someone goes in and makes a change to the ARM template, redeploys it, that manual change is going to go. It's going to override it.
That just sounds terrifying to me. Just in experience, you're saying if I built my environment with an ARM template and I make a parameter change, I just redeploy the thing, and that blow away the VM, so anything just gets to the settings.
Yeah, well, with ARM templates, they're incremental. So you make a change to your ARM templates, you can basically redeploy over the top. So a good example would be you've got a basic A0 instance of VM size, right? You can change that to a standard A1. You can run that ARM template again. And what it will do is do an incremental update to determine what's been changed. The virtual machine instance size has been changed, and then you can just run it over the top and it'll change it. It'll shut the machine down, but it'll reprovision the machine. It'll reboot it and change the size for you. So, as I mentioned here, ARM is incremental, so that's a really important thing to note. Tagging resources, I think we've covered that to death. Resource groups are really important too. So this freaks people out a lot too. Resource groups and designing those, they sort of define the application stack and grouping of resources together, hence the name resource groups. And I'm a big fan of layering the deployments. When I say layering, you've got different ARM templates for different parts of the stack. So if you find you've made a mistake in, say, the virtual machine, you just redeploy that ARM template. Rather than doing the whole lot, you just redeploy one of the tiers of the stack. It makes things so much easier. The other one, which is really funny, is you should store your ARM templates in a private repository. It's funny you see customers who put their enterprise-grade ARM templates in Git or GitHub. And we keep saying to them, well, you do realize that's a public repository, right? And if you've got keys or passwords in there, you can see where that's going to go. Now, the other one is, I talked a little about this yesterday, and I'll talk about it a little bit here, is you've got linked templates and layered templates. So what a linked template is a way of basically building up your stack from multiple templates and linking them together through a single master template, if you will, with all the parameters. So when you run it, it basically pulls all that infrastructure in and then deploys it all for you. And it's got all the parameters and everything, so it completely builds the entire stack for you. Can get very complicated, and there's no real way of doing that from a file share. So to do that linked template, you need to deploy those to a storage account, which has to be publicly accessible. But typically what you do is you make it a private repository and put a SAS token on it, and at runtime pull those in. The other thing we use quite heavily is Azure Automation. Who's never heard of Azure Automation? Who's never used it? Who wants to use it? Who doesn't care? I'm kidding. Azure Automation is something you shouldn't, you should really look at, because what that allows you to do is run scheduled task on a automated task on a schedule. Where this is really handy is we've got customers who run, remember I talked about resources that aren't tagged? PowerShell that runs through and goes and checks for those resources on a schedule and goes and shuts them down. That's how you would do it with Azure Automation. So think scheduled tasks in the cloud. It allows you to run PowerShell scripts and whatnot to go and do something in a schedule. It's very, very powerful. And it's really good. Like, we use it a lot. It's very, very easy to set up, and it's all ARM templatable and everything, except for setting up the SPN name. So what it needs is like a service account, effectively, to run the Azure Automation. There's no way I've found of doing that through ARM. You need to do it through PowerShell or through the portal. Some tips. I've got three here for you. Keep your Azure PowerShell and SDKs up to date. So if you're doing deployments regularly, please make sure you keep your PowerShell runtimes up to date. So run the installer from Microsoft and get the latest bits to make sure you've got those. Locking resource groups is a good one. So you want to stop people deleting resource groups, put a cannot delete resource lock on it and put RBAC controls on it. They can't delete it. They can't even delete the resources within it. It's locked away. The last one here is one of my favorites, and I've been guilty of this too, so I'll fess up on this one. Storing passwords in your ARM template parameter files. So you think about doing that and putting them in GitHub repo, and you've got, you know, critical systems with passwords stored in a GitHub repo. You can kind of guess what's going to happen. I've actually heard of cases of people going out and scanning Git repos, looking for passwords and keys. It happens all the time. It's actually very scary. So what I'd highly recommend, and in the session yesterday I did a demo of this, storing all your passwords and certificates in an Azure Key Vault. So what you can do at runtime is pull those passwords in, looks up a name value pair, pulls those keys in and passwords and pulls those in and deploys it for you. So I'd recommend using that. Another bonus tip, if you want to do Azure Automation and you want to do staggered deployments, the only way I found of doing that is via PowerShell. And hit me up later, I can give you some PowerShell to show you how to do it. It's very, very straightforward. Yeah.
How did you use a lockdown? We use Bitbucket, but use a lockdown repo as opposed to a public repo.
Yep.
It's a very simple exercise.
Yeah. The question is, using a public repo versus a private repo, is it easy to do? Yeah, it is. What you can do, you've got a few options. For us, we use GitHub Enterprise on-prem. Now, it might sound weird, but the reason we have to do that for us is we're PCI compliant. Whereas you can spin up a VSTS or Visual Studio Team Services instance, and that's running in the cloud, but make it private, and it's all secured via Azure Active Directory. I think that's free for 5 users, and then after that you've got to pay. But
the public cloud, Bitbucket's in the GitHub, so you've got private repos, is that?
If they're private repos inside a public cloud offering, you've locked them down, that's fine, as long as not the code is not public. Which I've seen happen. So you create a public repository and it's open to the world. You create a private repository in a public type GitHub repo, it's fine, as long as it's private.
You just have trouble getting the private ones working. So.
Yeah, usually the private ones too aren't free. So what are you using? Bitbucket?
Bitbucket's
fine. You can create a private repo and lock it down to, you know, a bunch of named users and whatnot. It's pretty straightforward. Can be a little bit fiddly. Where it gets interesting is when you want to try to integrate that with CI/CD pipelines in Azure, you've got to make sure you've got the Azure AD authorizing account or SPN account to connect to it. That's where it gets tricky. Some automation tips and tricks. A little bit of code. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Typically what we do is when we deploy resources, you can deploy resources via into different locations where the resource group is put. So for example, I've got a resource group in Australia East. I can put resources in Southeast Asia, but they're in that same resource group. Typically what we do, though, it really depends on what you want to do, is the we deploy the location where we deploy the resources as the default location of the resource group. So when we deploy resources, they're the same location as the resource group. And the other thing that's really interesting, if you need to create random numbers in your deployments and whatnot, you can use subscription ID and resource group ID at runtime in your variables to inject that so you can get random sort of values. The other ones are really, the one down the bottom here is a nice one. We use this a lot. It's called list keys. What it allows you to do is do dynamic lookups from one ARM template to the next. So as I talked about yesterday, I don't know if you guys saw that yesterday, but I talk about the outputs of an ARM template can be the inputs to the next one. But you can do this dynamically without having to do any manual cut and paste. I can, once a bunch of resources are deployed, I can pull those in using list keys based on those values there and then create and pull those values in, and it's all dynamic. The beautiful thing about this is it reduces the amount of parameters I need to pass in. So you can make it really smart on ways of deploying some of this stuff. Everyone see that? It's nice and blue, azure blue. Wasn't by accident. What we do is also too, as I think I mentioned yesterday, and I'm going to reiterate it again, it's important too, when you do it, when you're doing lots of ARM templates, is making sure you have outputs so you can see what's being spat out when you do your deployment. So there's outputs and you can see the values of what's being pushed out. So is there any questions on it? It's pretty straightforward. If you, once you start doing more and more ARM templates, you'll get an idea of what it sort of looks like. Let's get some more water. So monitoring. We heavily use monitoring. We do a lot of monitoring for our customers. We monitor at various levels. We look at virtual machines. We monitor the networking. We monitor everything. So we actually get notified about any issues before the customer does. And we use Log Analytics, basically, or OMS, depending on who you talk to at Microsoft, but it's Log Analytics. Interesting thing with OMS, it's at the subscription level. So remember I talked about the subscriptions and all of that? This is where this comes into play. It's very important to understand how you define your subscription model and how OMS relates to it. So when you start having more and more subscriptions, you have to create more and more OMS workspaces. They relate back to the subscription mapping. Now, from our side, from Rackspace, we also happen to support customers' environments at the subscription level. So it's a really nice way of tying it all together. And we capture a lot of metrics. There's a hell of a lot of metrics this thing can create and generate for us. We have to capture that and report on it. Obviously, everything's automated, so we do automated alerting and monitoring, and if there's something that doesn't look quite right, we automatically create a support ticket and it gets through our system and we can respond to it pretty quickly in like milliseconds because we've got webhooks and functions and all sorts of stuff. Some of the key metrics we look at with VMs are the ones down the bottom. Malware signatures, real-time protection, CP average greater than percent, recovery vault failures and whatnot. Interestingly enough, it's very difficult to get the heartbeat out of a VM in Azure. You'd think it'd be easy through OMS. It's actually quite difficult to do. We've asked the OMS guys about it, and they said you have to use the resource health to do it and write some custom PowerShell, but they are looking at it with some of the agent updates. So a little trick for young players, that one. It caught us out when we were looking at it. Oh, yeah, I had to put that in. Sorry. It's not a sales slide, but this is basically we've got two levels of support for the way we support Azure. So that's enough of that. We also support PaaS workloads. We monitor, obviously, app services, DocDB, Service Bus, Azure SQL. We monitor the lot. Interestingly enough, we're using App Insights for the URL monitoring. So we've got a bunch of websites that we monitor for customers. We use App Insights purely for the fact it's got multiple test locations, and I think it's 16 edge locations. So typically, we've got some large customers who've got a lot of web applications out there. We use App Insights for that. So typically, we set it up so it monitors from the close region, and then we monitor from too far. So we do that for every sort of region, every sort of web app. And then if an issue gets raised, if the URL ping comes back with an error, we'll call a webhook, which is hosted via an Azure function, push it into OMS, but we'll also call push it into our ticketing system, and then it all gets recorded, and an alert gets raised. Who's used OMS? Just a show of hands. Everyone like it? Pretty happy with it? There is a trap with it, though. It's got a 15-minute ingestion indexing interval. So if an issue happens, it takes a little while for it to come into OMS, and it can take up to 15 minutes for an alert to get raised. So depending on the SLA, that's a little trap for young players. Now, we're assured by Microsoft there's a feature coming called near real time, or NRT, which allows much lower intervals than that. So if you've got really business critical systems, OMS may not be the right choice right now to do that. You might have to do something custom. So we were looking at OMS for the as a replacement for App Insights, which, funny enough, there's integration coming for the URL monitoring, but we found it wasn't quick enough for us. We had to use App Insights, and we get sub-second test results from it. It's lightning quick. It's actually very impressive. Who's not seen OMS before? Anyone not seen it? This is kind of what it looks like. This is the old sort of dashboard. I believe they're merging this into Azure eventually. It's got its own sort of dashboard. It's got views and everything like that. It's actually really nice. We use it a lot, and we talk to the OMS team every fortnight. They give us so much stuff because we're a big customer. We're a big managed support partner of theirs. So we use this very, very heavily, and we give them a lot of feedback, and they give us a lot of stuff in return. So each of these squares here is basically like a view in OMS, and behind that, it's using queries. And those queries will pull in a bunch of information and roll it up into these charts. So, for instance, you've got system update assessment. You've got a bunch of virtual machines that haven't been patched in a while. You can click on that tile, drill in, and see what machines haven't been patched, what malware signatures haven't been updated, machines that aren't domain joined or uncontactable, that sort of thing. You can do that. It's very, very handy. Next screen are the alerts. We set up a heap of alerts. We automate this when we onboard customers. We set up a whole bunch of predefined queries that will raise an alert, go in our ticketing system. We're very strict about this. We push this onto all our customers, make sure they're supported, because there's the only way we can support it. So we have to be really careful with how we manage this. Yeah. It's all automatic. The question is, we do this automatically. It's completely automated. We have to, unfortunately, you can't do it with ARM templates, alerts. You have to do it with PowerShell, because it's got a particular JSON format. You need to push it in. You've got to change the format and push it in. We haven't found a way. You can create the OMS workspace with ARM template. It's just we've not found a way of creating the actual alerts. You've got to do that with PowerShell. I can give you, if you guys want samples, I can give you samples of some of that. This is what some of the queries look like. Apologies for some of this wacky looking code, but it's very, very SQL-esque. So the top one's an interesting one we use when we want to keep track of what customers are deploying. What we can do is set this alert up. If there's zero activity and someone goes and does an ARM template deployment, we can get OMS to go and check it for us and notify us when customers are doing updates to the ARM templates. Doing deployments based on the updates to the ARM templates, and we can trap that. It's handy. It's just good to keep developers under control, which we often have to do. The bottom one's pretty straightforward. Malware signatures out of date. So that we can trigger that every 5 minutes to go and check a whole bunch of machines. All that log analytics comes into OMS, and we can run these queries over the top to see what machines haven't been patched. This is one that's near and dear to my heart. Now, this one's a little bit different. You notice type equals SQL Azure underscore CL. That means it's a custom one. So this is something we got from Microsoft. They provided us a bunch of solutions that allow us to monitor Azure SQL. I think they've finally been released. But what happens is it goes and creates a custom log. So we can go in and monitor Azure SQL, Service Bus, any of the PaaS solutions. We can monitor it through OMS as well. It's a little bit trickier to set up, but once you've got it, it's all completely automated. So what this is telling me is if it's average CPU utilization over 80% over 10 minutes, do something. So we can set an alert based on this metric, and it'll automatically alert us and fire a webhook and call, let a ticket be raised and whatnot. We do this all the time for Azure SQL when the DTU limits in Azure SQL reach a certain threshold. And we're looking at providing some sort of predictive analytics in the future so we can actually predict failure a little bit better. So it's a constant moving thing. Any questions on any of that? Pretty straightforward. All right, some of the key takeaways. These are like the top 10s. This is sort of a roll-up of everything. So use named accounts. Use billing alerts where you can, use subscriptions. As I mentioned, automated shutdown. Save yourself a lot of money. Trust me, you will save a lot of money. Also, too, make sure you deallocate the VMs. So if you turn a VM off, shut it down, it'll deallocate it and you only pay for the storage. Yeah, enable encryption when you're provisioning, not after. Remember I talked about you've got to move storage out, recopy it back in, otherwise it won't work. Prefix storage accounts, well, that's not really a big issue if you're going to use managed disks. So I'd highly encourage looking at managed disks. And there's a lot of information around that that's just come out. So it's very, very cool. Yeah, avoid network security groups at the NIC level. Interestingly enough, I do believe that there are nested security groups coming out. So it allows you to layer your nested network security groups, which is going to be happy days for us. You know, layer upon layer of security, you're going to find there's going to be all these different sorts of race conditions to work some of this out. Keep your tools up to date. That's actually quite important because you may find that you're doing stuff with ExpressRoute or whatnot. It doesn't work. So we've had cases where you've tried to provision an ExpressRoute circuit. It doesn't work. Update the tools. It magically works because the APIs have changed. Microsoft changes the APIs quite a bit, and they do version the APIs as well. So a little trick is make sure you keep your tools up to date, otherwise certain things won't work. I said lock resource groups, cannot delete, so it's like locking resources if you don't want them to be deleted. Yeah, don't store passwords in prem files. It's not a great idea. It's against your company policy. And OMS, 15 minutes. Any questions? So do you want me to leave it up a little bit so you can get shots of it? Or yeah, mate. Yeah, the question is, how do we manage self-service against managed services? It's a difficult one. Typically, what we do is, depending on the level of support a customer would get, the customer can anytime say, give us the ARM templates, we'll take it from there. And they can take it, it's their code, we can do. On the flip side of that, we get some customers go, I don't want to know about it. You run it, you build it, just send me the bill. So it really varies on the type of customer. We've got customers who have taken the ARM templates we've built for them, and totally ripped them apart and refactored them, put them into TeamCity and Octopus Deploy. So it really varies on customer to customer. To answer your question, it's not always easy. Especially when you've got developers who know a bit about doing some of this DevOps stuff, it can get really, really tricky because ultimately we've got to support it. So luckily with OMS, it's easier to support some of this stuff because it auto-enrolls a lot of the support for you, so you can it'll take care of itself for the most part. Sorry, there's another question? Yeah.
Late last year, Microsoft released the new reference architecture templates.
Yep.
Have you seen them, or have you got any comments on them?
The question was the release. All the architecture documents?
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of the Microsoft reference architectures that have been released. Yeah, they're actually quite good. They used to be 3D, now they're 2D. I'm not sure what happened there. They used to be really nice 3D isometric view, now they've gone sort of 2D. Maybe they're going back to the Metro look, I don't know, but, you know. Yeah, no, they're actually very good. We try to use ours ourselves. Because most of the ones we have, most of them are kind of cookie-cutter type deployments. So you want three virtual machines, you want to do this and this and this. They're kind of easy. Where we get some of the bigger ones that are a bit more esoteric, that's where you have to sort of deviate from the standard sort of build. We actually have quite a large repository of ARM templates that we use as a base, and we basically create a brand new repository per customer and customize them based on the customer requirements so we can replay it. No, but to answer your question, they're actually pretty good. They're actually quite good. Good place to get started. Yeah, mate? Yep. The question is, any comments on managed virtual desktop type thing? We do have some. We actually got our own reference architectures. It's not my, unfortunately, not my area of expertise, but we do have some reference architectures, like with RDS and all of that. We do have some of those, so we do support that. We've got ARM templates that will build a complete RDS farm with certificates and everything like that.
Like DSC to set up RDS.
Yeah, DSC. Yeah, we set up DSC. We use custom script extensions, DSC. We've got a whole bunch, so it's completely automated. We've almost got it to a point now we can completely automate a customer environment without ever having to go into the Azure portal.
Can we use almost.
I think they use push servers to do it. It depends, yeah, how they do it. There's one more question I thought. Yeah, man.
Do you have to roll your own billing tool?
Ah, yes. we're sort of going through this process now. So the question is, have you had to roll your own billing tool? We've had to go in and call the billing APIs and whatnot to consolidate it. It's actually a real pain, a real thorn in our side for some of this stuff because you've got large enterprises, they've got EAs. So the only way to get access to it is to go to the EA portal. Yeah. And if you don't have access to it, some customers go, no, you're not going near it. And like, they say to us, you should be able to tell us what we're spending. We're like, well, we don't know, because we may not have access to all your subscriptions. We don't know. The only way to do that is at the EA portal level. We are looking at a few tools. The one we use the most is the EA billing tool for Azure, you know, the Power BI tool. We're looking at more and more of that. Because some customers go, what are we spending? What are the underutilized resources? And how much are we being charged? Especially when the developers have got prod access. It does our head in. They just spin stuff up, don't shut it down. Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, we're trying to make it more self-service oriented, where the people incur the cost and visibility of it.
Yeah.
That's where you start running into a lot of challenges, as you mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a challenge, because the problem is you've got a bunch of devs out there with prod access or, you know, other subscription access. They can spin up whatever they want. The thing is, maybe you need to enforce a tagging policy or shutting things down.
Spending limits
is a help. I've sat down with customers and we've gone through and actively deleted stuff in their environment because the IT manager has no idea what it is. He started shutting down and deleting stuff. It's very funny to watch. It's like meerkats popping up. Who deleted my VM? There's all these developers popping up. It was actually hilarious. Well, it was hilarious at the time. It's like these developers were popping up. Oh, my VM's gone. It's like, why have you put it in South Central? It's crazy. So, you know, you got to rein them in. Any other questions, comments? So I have to go to the last, because we've got... make sure there's... A lot of this is basically real-world sort of... experience that we've found. There's a lot of other stuff I haven't covered. There's just so much of this stuff, but this is some of the things that we see quite often, just to give you guys a bit of awareness of things to look out for. And if you do evaluation, you can go in the Spark After Dark draw for the drone racing tonight. You get a pilot pass, so make sure you sign up for that. So I'll be around. I'll be at the Rackspace booth. I'll hang around a little bit outside if you want to grab me in, grab my card or ping me here. I've got to just get out before the next session. So thank you for coming. Oh, and my details are there. If you want to email me, aaron.sikorsky@rackspace.com. If you don't want to talk to me, that's fine.